Disrespect will take you places you can't get to from here. Disrespect entertains with a look at the challenges and sometimes the successes of people with disadvantages and disabilities who have had taken from them or have been denied the full choice of possibilities to affect for the better their own lives or the lives of those about them. Disrespect must be moving into the big leagues. Everybody we speak to needs to speak to somebody else, needs somebody else's approval, or has to double the number of calls we make using voicemail. As a result, we have interviews in the works, but this week, you got your 1% increase if you're on fixed income. You got it last month if you're on welfare. You got it this month if you're on Ontario Disability Support. Don't spend it all in one place. This interview is a retrospective about Dalton McGuinty's last welfare increase cut from 3% to 2%, complaining that 3% and 2% are all about the same. 1% seems to fit the mold. So for Dalton McGuinty, here's Rule Amdur, who I relentlessly call Royal throughout the interview. And listen if you can, because this will show up at fundraising time again, for Rule's piercing and priceless explanation of why single mothers get shafted on fixed incomes. Today, Disrespect welcomes Royal Amdur, a retired social welfare supervisor from Valmont, Quebec. Royal, how are you?
Okay. We're interested in the material that appeared in Vue and the Ontario welfare increases. First, I have to say, I'm surprised that you would live in Quebec and that you would comment so incisively and so often on Ontario welfare. Do you have an interest in the situation here?
Yeah, well, I'd lived just across the river from Ottawa.
Okay.
And I was a welfare supervisor while I lived here. And before that, I lived in Ontario for many years.
Oh, okay, so you commuted to Ontario to supervise welfare.
Yeah, it's half an hour away.
Okay. You published in Straight Goods. I know you published in Vue. Is there anywhere else you would like our listeners to be able to look for your work?
A number of things appeared in Pulse Niagara that weren't in Vue.
Okay.
Also had a few things in The Social Edge.
Is that on the web?
Yeah, it's a web zine.
All right. The article makes a number of interesting points that the first of which is that the net gain for people on fixed incomes is about 0.2%.
That's through 2003. Now, if we go into 2004, that's probably disappeared.
You mean it's a zero or less?
Probably by this point.
So it includes the McGuinty increase?
Yeah.
Okay. And it dates back to when? What period are you accounting for here in the 0.2%?
We're talking about the increase from 2002 to 2003.
Okay.
Which was an increase of minus 2.8%. So he increased 3% in 2004, which means it's a net increase of 0.2%.
In the 1 year?
As of 2003.
Right.
But the increase occurred in 2004. That 0.2% is probably wiped out by now.
Okay. And it looks like this is worse for single-parent families.
Single-parent families, if you have a single-parent family with one child,
right,
then in the 2002 to 2003, they lost 3.8%, so the 3% increase is really a loss of 0.8%.
Okay.
If you're dealing with a couple and two children, so that if they get 3% now, it's a loss of 0.8%. A couple and two children, between those 2 years, it's a loss 4.4%.
Oh, my goodness.
In every respect, people are worse off after the supposed 3% increase than they were before.
And you put this down to, at the end of the article, to a hostility toward welfare recipients. It appears almost a hostility toward single parents.
Oh, definitely. Single parents are walking Rorschach tests. There's a tendency to blame them for all kinds of things. Just think of Mike Harris's comment about pregnant, beer-swilling women. There's this kind of attitude towards single parents.
Where does it come from?
In one of the articles that I had in The Social Edge, I traced it to what I think is a psychological factor, which is that people need to project their forbidden sexual desires onto somebody else.
Right.
These single parents are an important target for this sort of thing. As I said, they're walking Rorschach tests. People look at them and project all of their negative feelings onto these unfortunate persons.
So the fact that they're unattached
and have children
almost makes them targets for a kind of stalking.
There must be something evil about such people who do things that I would like to do but don't dare. They're getting away with something that I can't do.
Okay. Be it having fun or having a family or whatever.
Having fun, having sex. And so that's what's happening.
I have a single parent associate who is affiliated with the show who would probably dispute the accusation that she's having too much fun. She has two kids, and it's a big commitment, but it's interesting that you would draw that out.
It's not a matter of she is in fact having fun.
No.
It's a matter of this is...
This is the perception.
This is what is going on inside certain ids, such as that of Mike Harris.
Right. So it finds its way into welfare policy.
McGuinty's government has not pursued the assault on welfare recipients that Mike Harris was pursuing.
Right. They took away the lifetime suspension for fraud.
And they're not waging a public relations battle against poor people the way that Harris was.
Right.
However, we're not seeing substantial changes in policy.
Right.
When you look at the increase of assistance of 3% across the board, that's after Harris cut 21.6% from the recipients of Ontario Works.
To make welfare unlivable.
Yeah, that is something that has not been reversed by McGuinty. When you add 3% across the board, that's really not the answer. The first thing you have to do is you have to put back the 21.6%, then you talk about how much you're going to increase everybody.
Well, and that opportunity was lost. People would say, why now, if you did it now? If it was fair before, why didn't you do it then?
That should have been the first order of business in terms of welfare reform, putting back the money that was taken away by Harris.
There are a lot of people who still believe that there's a lot of welfare fraud and that a lot of people on welfare are getting money unfairly and undeservedly.
I don't think that McGuinty is of that view. I do think that there are people in the Liberal caucus that are.
Oh.
Not in the top echelons, but in the caucus.
Okay. It's found its way into other aspects of fixed income administration, too, like the spouse in the house rule. I don't know how long that's existed, but that's promoting abuse of mostly women.
Well,
a woman without money is a woman without choice.
That is a complicated one. The thing that Harris did was to say that as soon as a person applies, then a determination has to be made as to the status of spouse in the house. This person could be considered a source of income.
Right.
Depending on whether or not this person is seen as a spouse.
Right.
Now, the change has been to go back to a previous policy, which says that only after 3 years can such a determination be made.
Is that the case now?
Yes.
Now, so you can actually be a couple for 3 years without suffering a financial penalty.
Unless you have a child together, unless you've ever been married.
To each other?
Yes. Now, the whole thing is after 3 years, it's extremely difficult to determine whether or not people are a couple, because a court case has held that sexual relations are not to be considered. That's not new. That's been that way for years and years. But it's a bizarre kind of world where you have to make the decision in terms of, do they go to church together? Do they have a joint bank account?
Oh.
Do they recognize each other in their wills? What do the children refer to the other person as? Are they known socially as a couple? It gets very, very complicated to determine whether or not people are, in fact, a couple under regulation as it exists. And, in fact, nobody knows how to interpret it.
So the interpretation becomes problematic then?
Problematic because there are issues to look at, but there is no way of defining precisely how much evidence would amount to you're married, how little would result in, no, you're just living together.
Right.
It's a very confusing piece of business. It's a matter of asking, what do your children refer to this other person as?
Oh, I see.
Your friends. You know, you ask them ordinarily.
So it's kind of an obstacle course of giving the right answers.
Yeah.
And hasn't been resolved by the Liberal government.
Hasn't been resolved by anybody. It's been that way for years and years.
You've also mentioned the clawback.
The new increase is not clawed back. The increase that occurred in July.
Right.
But it's a relative small amount. The bulk of the thing is still clawed back. And the third of quite poor are being denied this benefit. And the question is, we're trying to help poor children. What kind of mad policy is this?
McGuinty's, his administration's notice that's gone out with the checks says that they're reconsidering this policy, but it doesn't promise any end to it. I read an article also in the recent copy of View about a meeting in the States prior to the Democratic National Convention in Boston, where Tom Hayden spoke about gang warfare and how it's ruined the American inner city, and he makes an interesting statement there that this is a blatant example of what has happened with the eroding of a social fabric and should be seen as what could happen should Canada continue to decimate our social programs. Is this a realistic assessment of the impact of these ongoing, punitive, and increasingly devastating cuts?
I don't see the American example occurring here in the near future. I think that some of the kinds of things you're going to see are increasing homelessness. You see, I've worked with the homeless at times.
Right.
And these were mainly people who were extremely dysfunctional.
Right.
They were people who had mental health problems, substance use problems, mental deficiency, sometimes more than one of these things. And I think what is happening is we're getting a much better grade of homelessness.
Okay. Better people are becoming homeless.
Right.
Now for a break with Al Green. Appropriately, I've been waiting on you. Oh, baby. What took you so long? I've been waiting by the phone. Boy, you've been home. Where have you gone? What do you?
I've been waiting on you. waiting on you.
$536 a month for Ontario Works.
Okay.
In Hamilton. Can you find a place for $536? And that's for not only rent, but food as well.
That's right.
Sole support parent with one child under 12. New maximum rate is $987 a month for the whole
rent,
for
food,
the whole
utilities,
ball.
Everything, transportation.
Couple with two children under 12, $1,215.
Okay.
Maximum.
All right.
We're talking about pretty hard kinds of situations, and as a result, more people are homeless.
Right. You mentioned the measure of poverty here, the StatsCan low-income cutoff, and that it's a relative measure.
There's another measure which was done by HRDC, called the market basket measure, and the results were very similar.
Oh, how close?
It's quite similar, so that even if the rationale for the low-income cutoffs being considered a poverty line is poor, the fact that this other measure is very similar means that you just don't throw it out the window.
Yeah, for sure. And, of course, it's more punitive in the large urban areas where you're likely to find more poverty, like Toronto.
Well, that is perhaps the case. But if you go into some rural areas, there are additional problems. For example, transportation might be a real difficulty.
How are we going to get out of this situation?
I think it's a matter of people demanding better. The poor tend to be the legitimate target. It's no longer permissible to hate blacks and Jews and even gays.
That's true.
But the poor continue to be
stigmatized.
And part of that is there are certain class interests. The affluent like to blame the poor. But also the people that earn $10 a week more than people on social welfare also resent them. Because,
they're ardent conservatives, aren't they? A lot of them.
A lot of them, because I have to work for my pittance, and these people get it free.
Mm-hmm.
There's this kind of feeling that exists. It's a matter of pitting the poor against the poor.
Right. You feel that people want to work, and that their desire to work is not much affected by the amount of money that they receive for not working. That, in fact, work is a declaration of personal esteem and personal value that most people want to make regardless.
That's right. I argue, for example, that if a single person wanted to get more on welfare, that person would move to the Yukon, because the Yukon pays substantially more for single people on welfare, and even with their higher cost of living, a single person would come out ahead.
Is this true in the territories as well?
Yeah. in the Northwest Territories.
What is substantially more? And do they have disability income programs that top the welfare program as we do here?
The disability program is quite similar
right.
to welfare in the Yukon, which I think makes sense.
So the income levels are similar.
Single person employable in the Yukon gets $1,012 a month as of 2003.
Okay.
Just slightly more with disability. So that a person in Ontario were motivated to milk the system that some Tory politicians do, what they do is they move to the Yukon.
Right.
And I haven't seen any massive movement to the Yukon.
No, this is true. Do you have any advice to our listeners about this situation? I mean, people who are spending an inordinate amount of time trying to find ways around this low income, people who are commuting from relative to work because they're homeless, or people who are spending all their time with children as single parents because they get no supports, no daycare, no very little income for rent or anything else.
It's a matter of raising it with other people, with their churches, with
mm-hmm.
politicians,
mm-hmm.
That sort of thing. If people are on welfare, for example, and there is some possibility of disability, then they should definitely pursue disability, because the amount of difference in income in Ontario is staggering.
Yes.
For example, single employable maximum on the new rate is $536, $959 for a disabled person.
Right. Almost double, as you said.
Unfortunately, I think that the welfare departments tend not to put a lot of emphasis on helping people move from general assistance from Ontario Works onto the provincial program. One appropriate target would be local welfare departments, to push them to do a much more thorough job in helping get on ODSP, on the provincial disability benefits.
Right.
They talk about Ontario Works being short term.
Yeah.
And this is a lot of baloney.
Right.
Because when I was a welfare supervisor, I saw cases that had histories going back 25 years.
Right.
And that ain't short term.
No.
And little effort was being made and is being made to move these people onto a disability program on a systematic basis. It's a hit and miss kind of proposition, and there's not a formal push in that direction. Also, the legal aid clinics have a role to play in representing people. However, this is such a major part of their work that sometimes they can't handle all the cases. And, for example, I have represented a number of people appealing disability because the legal clinic was not able to handle it. They sent the person to the legal aid society to get a certificate, and then with the certificate, they have to get a lawyer. It behooves them, I think, to make appropriate referrals to legal aid if they can't handle the case
mm-hmm.
load.
Mm-hmm.
And in Ottawa, that's what's been happening.
I see.
The only problem occurs where someone owns a home.
All right.
Because then legal aid wants to put a lien on it. ODSP never did.
Okay.
It was in the regulations, and I don't think it's been removed.
Okay.
And that was put in by Mike Harris. Before that, it didn't exist.
Oh, so he put it in for OW.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right.
So if you need legal aid assistance, basically you've got to move out of your home, or you've got to suffer the lien for the cost.
Well, the lien, yeah. Now, there have been cases that I've had where I'd gone and seen somebody, and it was a matter of, you know, there's a lien that's going to be placed on your house if I represent you. And I'd called the legal clinic and say, look, take this guy and give me somebody else, because you don't want his home to have a lien on it.
Oh, okay.
And they've been willing to do that.
Very shrewd. Do you think the Ontario Human Rights Commission finally has a a role to play here. They are a creature of the government. They are entirely funded by the government. They have to tread carefully on political toes. But Keith Norton, the commissioner in Ontario, has been more vocal than past commissioners about injustices to the disadvantaged, particularly to people with disabilities. But it seems there's a limit to what he can say. Sometimes the truth is just a little too tough to bite off for these people because they're underfunded to begin with and because their funding comes from the people that they're critical of.
I think that the kinds of issues around amount of assistance and so on are not easily placed in the Human Rights Commission.
Right.
The Human Rights Commission has a role to play. They play a role in terms of discrimination against people on welfare in the field of housing.
Right.
You can't discriminate against someone in renting because the person is on welfare. However, if all you get is $536 a month, you may be out of the market, not because you're on welfare, but because you just don't have the money to pay for a rental.
Well, and they wouldn't attack the government for paying them only $536 a month. Their penalties are kind of shy of what would get attention too, aren't they? I mean, they use the media very effectively, but they can't issue like punitive amounts
can.
Or anything.
They can.
Well, $1,500 or something.
Well, if you're a small landlord and you discriminate and you get hit with $1,500, that's no fun.
Okay. Yeah.
Now,
I hear you.
If on the other hand you're a huge real estate agent. That's another matter. I believe that welfare should be adequate.
Right.
And it should be adequate for everybody, regardless of whether they're disabled or not.
Right.
The disability things should be covered, you know, if there are special disability needs, such as walkers or special diet and so on. They should be covered for people, whether they're on disability or on just general welfare.
Right. Accommodating the people with disabilities who don't qualify for the disability income.
Yeah, and because the Ontario Works is so low, a major push should be made to get everybody who is potentially eligible onto the higher program.
Right. So yours is a kind of a human rights approach.
I'm not sure I would describe it that way. I would describe it as an equity approach.
Equity, okay.
I think it's also it's a matter of looking at social welfare, social assistance as part of the fabric of the social safety net.
Yes.
And basically that people should be entitled to live in conditions of dignity and decency, which are not possible with the current welfare rates.
I think that's about as conclusive as it gets. I really appreciate your taking the time to say that today.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. Well, we hope to read some more from you, and thanks for coming on the show.
Well, thanks for having me.
All right, Ryle.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And now it's time for Disrespect's weekly review of the news. These aren't the stories from the newspapers that we read to you, but these are condensations or abridgments of the stories from the papers that we name on the broadcast. Province urges Ford to apply penny-pinching ways to welfare program payments. The McGuinty government's calling on Rob Ford to stick to his penny-pinching ways when it comes to provincial funding. The issue involves a long-standing disagreement between the City of Toronto and the Ontario government over the cost of running a province-wide welfare program. Toronto has asked the province for $53.7 million to help run the program in the city, a request made well before Mr. Ford swept to victory in October's municipal election. Although the province has agreed in principle to pay half the cost of administering the program in Ontario, it has not agreed on an amount, said Finance Minister Dwight Duncan. He suggested that Mr. Ford, who campaigned in the mayoral race on reducing waste in the system, should be agreeable to lowering the city's funding request. Mr. Ford declined to discuss the funding request made by his predecessor, saying he'll address the matter next month when he meets with Premier Dalton McGuinty. The formula for determining the cost per caseload has not been changed since 2000. At the same time, the number of people receiving social assistance benefits in Ontario has risen sharply since the onset of the global economic slowdown 2 years ago. At the end of October, 451,540 residents were receiving Ontario Works benefits, up 22% from October 2008. The province agreed 2 years ago to take back responsibility for funding social services that had been shifted to cash-strapped municipalities in the mid-1990s. As part of the accord, the province agreed to pick up the entire tab for welfare costs beginning in 2010 and phased in over 8 years. Prior to the agreement, municipalities paid 20% of the program costs for Ontario Works. That article in the Globe and Mail by Karen Howlett and Kelly Grant in Toronto. Hey, Mr. McGuinty, I know where you can pick up another 451,540 votes. If welfare rules worked, so could Linda. After 3 decades of battling schizophrenia and homelessness and poverty, Linda Chamberlain finally got a job. She worked 2.5 days a week as a peer support worker on the very floor where she once lived at the Center for Mental Health and Addiction. It'd be hard to find a better success story. Except under the antediluvian web of provincial rules, she lost half of her paycheck to the government, while her rent, geared to income, skyrocketed by 471%. Her bills mounted. She was constantly hungry. She started carrying an empty container to work in case there was a platter of fruit or sandwiches on offer. "It was killing me slowly," says 61-year-old Chamberlain. Pink hair, pink glasses, pink cardigan, pink lipstick. "I was worried I'd get back out drinking and self-harming." Staff threw 2 goodbye parties for her, one for the patients with vanilla cake and pink balloons, and the other for all the doctors and nurses who wore pink puffs in their jacket pockets or pink blouses in her honor. "I just loved that job," Chamberlain tells me. "It was all I could do to hold back tears." Welfare policy expert John Stapleton looked into Linda's case. His key point, for every dollar Linda earned over $440 a month, one set of government workers increased her rent, while another set took half her paycheck. The right hand does not talk to the left. Linda's municipal landlord counted her earnings at 100%, although social services had effectively cut them by 50%. Linda's story shows us that we are also strangely willing to penalize disabled people for working, not once, but twice. If they got their own paychecks, where would we funnel our anger? An expert panel corralled by Community and Social Services Minister Madeleine Meilleur proposed 13 quick fixes that would address the welfare system's most vicious and self-defeating regulations. Meilleur implemented only 4. Among the 9 outstanding is what Stapleton now calls the Linda Chamberlain rule. It would come down to a simple word change: set subsidized rental rates to a person's net, not their gross income. Why won't Meilleur do that? She told The Star's Laurie Monsabraton it wouldn't be prudent during a recession. But how does it save us money to force Chamberlain and the 4,000 other part-time workers who receive government disability checks to quit their jobs? "When you're working, you start to feel valued. You feel good about yourself," says Chamberlain. "It gives you such great self-esteem and confidence and gives you back the dignity you lost through the stigma of mental health." "I miss getting a paycheck and being able to shop on a Friday like everyone else," she says as we part ways. "Don't you love working?" That story by Catherine Porter in the Toronto Star, Saturday, November 20th, 2010. Poor to Cry program cut. Cash top-up helps welfare recipients buy healthy food. Lauren Mavella was only 18 when she left home. She won't say why, but it wasn't by choice. Having to go on welfare to survive wasn't either, she says. Her monthly Ontario Disability Support Program check barely covered rent, and what little was left had to go to food. "It was not healthy food. I had to eat cheap," said the 22-year-old Hamilton woman. Mavella was among about 60 anti-poverty advocates who took to Hamilton's streets Friday the 26th to decry the Ontario government's plan to scrap the special diet allowance for qualified welfare recipients. What's cheap to eat? Things such as bulk pasta, bargain sauces, the poorest cuts of meat, she said. Fresh fruits and vegetables were often an unaffordable luxury. Already struggling with morbid obesity, when the province sent Mavella for gastric bypass surgery in Michigan, an operation she says saved her life by allowing her to shed 200 pounds in relatively short order. But new health problems arose. She could no longer tolerate eating wheat or digest lactose, and she became iron and vitamin B12 deficient. Her doctors approved her for the province's special diet allowance, which gives her an additional maximum $250 on top of her disability allowance. In its provincial budget earlier this year, Dalton McGuinty's Liberal government announced it would be eliminating the special diet welfare allowance in favor of a new nutritional supplement plan through the health ministry. The reason, the province said, was that one in five welfare recipients now receives the special diet allowance, and the program had ballooned from $6 million in 2003 to more than $200 million in 2008. "If I get my special diet taken away, I will end up in the hospital, and my weight will probably balloon back up," Mavella said. The current maximum single adult welfare assistance is $585 a month and just over $1,000 for disability support, said rally co-organizer Michelle Hruska of the Campaign for Adequate Welfare and Disability Benefits. The protesters marched from Gore Park to City Hall. "The special diet allowance is to help you buy healthy food to combat whatever illness you have," she said. "We're very concerned they will narrow the guidelines and make it harder for people to get access to it." The government is now hinting it will take another look at its plan to scrap the special diet food cash top-up. "I'm looking forward to announcing a social assistance review and the direction for special diet allowance very soon," said Community and Social Services Minister Madeleine Mayer in an email. Mayer's communications advisor, Rebecca McKenzie, said a decision to remove the special diet allowance hasn't been made yet. That in the Hamilton Spectator. That was Saturday, November 27th, by Paul Morse. A leap of faith for hydro consumers. Green energy comes with a hefty down payment and a long-term payoff. The long-term energy plan Dalton McGuinty's government unveiled underscores that Ontarians are about to start paying heavily for green energy. And for the next few years, the investment will be wildly disproportionate to its role in the system. The government acknowledges that residential prices will go up by 46% in the next 5 years and that green energy will be responsible for more than half of that increase. The solar costs are especially striking because the Liberals have committed to rates they themselves consider too high. This past summer, realizing they were overpaying, they tried, retroactively, to reduce the rates, paid largely to farmers, for small ground-mounted projects to 58.8 cents per kilowatt hour from 80.2. Then, in the face of a backlash in rural ridings, they dropped the retroactive part and set a compromise and still very high price of 64.2 cents for new projects. Wind power doesn't involve quite the same extravagance. If the government is correct that a $14 billion investment will get it up to 10% of total supply, it will play a real role as a substitute for power from coal-fired plants. The government is at least getting something obvious in return, not least being a help avoiding whatever price is eventually charged for carbon emissions. Having now clearly set out the price of this leap of faith, the Liberals can at least argue their temporary 10% rebate on energy bills, initially reported last week as a pre-election price reduction rather than a moderate blunting of price hikes, has some policy merits rather than just political ones. Ultimately, by far the biggest expenditure will be on refurbishing and procuring nuclear reactors. So stretching the expenses on wind and solar over a longer period by adding $1 billion to the provincial debt each of the next 5 years might be a reasonable balancing act. But it remains to be seen whether they can make Ontarians feel reasonably assured about what they're buying into. That by Adam Radwanski in the Globe and Mail, Wednesday, November 24th. Government underestimating hydro bill increase, critics say. The government pegs the cost of building two new reactors and refurbishing 10 existing ones at $33 billion in its long-term energy plan. But opposition members and industry observers said the refit of two mothballed reactors at the Bruce Power Nuclear Station on Lake Huron is now likely to be $4.8 billion, $2 billion more than the original estimate. There's no credibility behind the cost estimate, said Keith Stewart, an energy analyst and anti-nuclear campaigner at Greenpeace Canada. Progressive conservative energy critic John Jakubowski is a fan of nuclear energy, but he said consumers should be bracing for their hydro bills to rise more than the government's estimate of 3.5% a year over the next two decades. The average bill, based on residences that consume 800 kilowatt hours a month, will climb to $228 by 2030, including inflation, from $114 today, the government said. By comparison, the average bill was $53 in 1990. Nuclear energy will remain the backbone of Ontario's electricity system. Half of the province's electricity will come from nuclear power. Green energy will account for 13% by 2030, up from 3% today. That's not a modernized system, said Dr. Stewart. That's really the old system with a little green trim around the edges. The government is also embarking on an ambitious nuclear expansion program amid enormous uncertainty over the future of Atomic Energy of Canada Limited. The federal government did not help by any means by putting AECL up for sale in the middle of our procurement process, Energy Minister Brad Duguid said at a news conference. The two new reactors the province plans to buy would be capable of producing 2,000 megawatts, enough to power 1.6 million homes a year. The government is determined to get a fair price from AECL, Mr. Duguid said. That by Karen Howlett in the Globe and Mail from Toronto, Wednesday, November 24th. Ambulance Bay, now ER, Ontario Tory leader says. McGuinty Wing. An overcrowded Mississauga hospital has moved some of its overflow emergency room operations to an unlikely location, the parking lot. The Credit Valley Hospital said it renovated an ambulance bay to accommodate spikes in demand like those that happened during the H1N1 pandemic in 2009. The renovations include heating and other necessary utilities for patient care, according to an email from Krista Finlay, a hospital spokeswoman. Provincial Progressive Conservative leader Tim Hudak raised the issue in the legislature at Queen's Park, where he called the overflow emergency room a dirty garage. "We're calling it the McGuinty Wing," he said, referring to the province's Liberal premier. Conservatives circulated an undated picture of the ambulance bay, which resembles a windowed parking lot. The party said the photo was taken November 1st and revealed oil stains and dust on the floor of the ambulance bay. Dwight Duncan defended his government's record of increased health investments and contrasted it to the previous Tory government. "You were part of a government that closed hospitals and fired nurses," he said to Mr. Hudak. Earlier this month, the hospital announced plans to open 24 new acute care beds to serve a new wing that is set to open next spring. In October, hospital executives were under fire over revelations Credit Valley spent $80,000 on outside lobbyists to help with its expansion. That story in the National Post by Lee Greenberg. and stay with the news while we take a break with Benny King asking Dalton McGinty, figuratively, what is soul?
What is soul? What is soul, babe? Some few people really know. It's deep within us, it doesn't show. A soul is something that comes from deep inside.
In Quebec healthcare, Quebecers' cancer battle reveals access to care disparities. After pneumonology tests confirmed it, Louis-André Carly received the devastating diagnosis lung cancer. He'd quit smoking completely when he was 43 and then led a rigorously healthy lifestyle. Because his overall health was good, Mr. Carly reacted positively to his first round of chemotherapy. "I received what is considered the standard treatment," Mr. Carly says. After doing some research and reading an article by Dr. Normand Blais, a respected Quebec hemato-oncologist, he learned that other treatments with lesser side effects are approved for treatment of lung cancer, but are not necessarily offered to patients in Quebec because of the drug approval process in the province. "We were shocked and angry," says Guylaine Leduc, Mr. Carly's wife. "Why should some cancer patients have access to those treatments but not others? Oncologists are aware of the alternatives, and it sounds like they cannot discuss them freely with their patients," she says. "Their hands are tied." Mr. Carly underlines that because it can be correlated to smoking, lung cancer doesn't attract as much natural sympathy as do other forms of cancer. Yet who can be sure? They've never been exposed to some kind of secondhand smoke. Mr. Carly is launching a petition to raise public awareness, and he is convinced that all actions are important to make people involved in the cause. This in a patient profile from Friday, November 26, Globe and Mail. Update on lung cancer. MLA ousted after slamming healthcare. The ruling Progressive Conservatives kicked provincial MLA and physician Raj Sherman out of government after he broke ranks with his party and joined other physicians in declaring a crisis of overcrowding in Alberta's emergency rooms. It's the second time in 2 years that Premier Ed Stelmach has booted out a colleague for speaking against the party line. Now Dr. Sherman, who still works weekend shifts in emergency, will take his battle across the aisle and sit as an independent. "I'm not quitting. I'm not crossing the floor to a rival party, and I'm not going to stop advocating for patience, said Dr. Sherman, who calmly called his ousting disappointing. Neither Dr. Sherman nor the Tories will explicitly say what prompted the first-term politician's dismissal, but it's undoubtedly tied to his recent critiques of the government. He wrote an email saying he can no longer support the health care decisions made by his government. He made waves again with a stinging rebuke of former health minister and current energy minister Ron Liepert. He refused to retract those comments. All told, the PC caucus chose to rid itself of its maverick. The news of Dr. Sherman's dismissal was one of two blows to the Stelmach government. In a quarterly fiscal update, it announced the projected deficit for the 2010-2011 year had grown by $257 million to approximately $5 billion on reduced oil production and a strong Canadian dollar. Last year, former Environment Minister Guy Boutillier was kicked out for saying his party wasn't doing enough for his community of Fort McMurray. But the dismissal of Dr. Sherman has legs that the dismissal of the often outspoken Mr. Boutillier did not. These guys must have completely lost their minds, this government. They just fired an ER doctor, the only ER doctor in the government, during an ER crisis, steamed MLA Rob Anderson, one of a handful of former PC members who have defected to the upstart Wild Rose Alliance. New Democrat Brian Mason called Dr. Sherman heroic. He stood up against the big machine. He knew that discipline was a likely outcome, and he did it anyway. Dr. Sherman will serve as an independent indefinitely. If he were to join another party, Wild Rose welcomed Mr. Boutillier, it would leave Mr. Stelmach facing a formidable foe with a keen understanding of a key topic. Health care is expected to be the top issue of the next election, likely in early 2012. That in Tuesday, November 23rd's Globe and Mail, Josh Wingrove in Edmonton. Friday, November 19th, Stephen Duckett, the chief executive officer of Alberta Health Services, emerged from a meeting about the crisis in the province's emergency rooms and refused to speak to reporters. Not a big deal except for his odd excuse. I'm eating my cookie. Can't you see I'm eating my cookie? At one point, as journalists chased Mr. Duckett down the street while he masticated his sugary snack, you would swear he actually spoke in the Cookie Monster voice. The video from CTV Edmonton is posted on YouTube, as is a hilarious mashup entitled Put That Cookie Down, Mr. Duckett. The CEO, who oversees a $10.9 billion budget and to a certain degree has the lives of people in his hands, should be respected, or at least feared. But he's become a laughingstock. Mr. Duckett has eaten the proverbial cookie. The Alberta Health Services Board has convened a teleconference to discuss his future. That meeting featured the letter F, because F is for firing. When Mr. Duckett was turfed, foes of restructuring would have done well to hold the applause. The fundamental problem remains. The government of Premier Ed Stelmach has absolutely no vision for health care. Alberta had in the past decade or so created the best, most innovative health system in Canada. Regionalization allowed health authorities to shape services to local needs, created better continuity of care, made the system more responsive, improved public health, and led to strong alliances between university researchers and health regions. There was also some healthy competition between regions that benefited patients. But regionalization also created powerful independent health leaders such as Sheila Wetherill of Edmonton and Jack Davis of Calgary, who used their influence to push for massive infrastructure investment, new research funding, and ever larger health budgets. Mr. Stelmach blew up the structure and replaced the regional health authorities with a single super board to oversee all health care services in the province. The move was motivated principally by petty politics. What Alberta got was political revenge posing as health reform and fiscal prudence. When the final calculation's done, it'll probably show that a lot more money has been wasted than saved. The experiment, or whatever it was, is a failure. Mr. Stelmach's response to Cookiegate has been to say he is tired of the theatrics in health care. He should be less concerned with appearances and more focused on instituting public policies that allow for the delivery of prompt, high-quality health care in a cost-effective manner. Fixing this mess is going to be a lot more painful than creating it. It requires leadership and a strong stomach. In the immortal words of the Cookie Monster, om nom nom nom. That by Andre Picard in Second Opinion in Thursday, September 25th's Globe and Mail. That's all the news we have this week. Come back next week. We will have more. And to take us out of our soul special disrespect, who else but Aretha Franklin? And some advice for our premier. Think. You can now listen to the show wherever you're near the internet. Disrespect is streamed live at http://cfmu.msumcmaster.ca. You can email us at dialogue, D-I-A-L-O-G-U-E, at radio.fm. Disrespect is archived at www.radioforall.net. That's the number four, not the word, radioforall.net. You can find the shows under its name, Disrespect. Tune in at Showtime, Thursdays at noon, 93.3 FM, CFMU, to see if something more topical hasn't displaced the show that we planned. Disrespect is digitally edited from live telephone and studio interviews.